This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A presidential election year should be the Super Bowl of political advertising. Clever, funny, distinctive ads should be grabbing our attention and our votes, but they're not. Despite record spending by both of the major party candidates, the most interesting political ads so far this season feature candidates named Miller and Budweiser in a race for president of beers. We don't often like to admit it, but a lot of commercials are pretty good. Many of their political cousins look and sound pretty much alike. We'll talk about the content and effect of the political ads we've seen thus far this year, and we'll talk about why most political ads are so lame. Later in the program, Library Journal's new Most Borrowed list and its interesting distinctions from the bestseller list. But first, political advertising. What political ads made you sit up and take notice? Have you ever had your mind changed by a political advertisement? And what do you want from a 30-second spot? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our first guest is Joshua Green. He's senior editor with the Atlantic Monthly magazine. He wrote Dumb and Dumber, Why Are Campaign Commercials So Bad? It's published in the July-August edition. And Josh, welcome back to Studio 3A.
Thanks.
So how bad are these ads?
I think most people would agree that they're pretty terrible. I mean, anybody who spent any time trying to watch television during the campaign season knows what it's like to sort of be bombarded by these sorts of things. It winds up feeling a little bit more like punishment than like politics. You get these same ads that have the same canned attacks, the same portent of doom narrator telling you that a miscast vote for first selectman is going to imperil the republic or cost us the war on terrorism. And it's pretty much uniformly bad. And I thought it'd be interesting to sort of look into why it is that you know, one of the most important decisions any of us make in the presidential race, why the ends for the ads for this tend to be worse than the ads that influence our choice of, say, light beer.
One of the conclusions you came to after talking to a lot of consultants and experts is that there are really only three messages that candidates want to put out.
Yeah, William Benoit, who's a communications professor at the University of Missouri, has studied political ads going back to the 1950s. And sort of came to the shocking conclusion that actually they all tend to say sort of the same thing. You can either attack your opponent, you can build up yourself, or you can defend yourself from an opponent's attack. And if you think about it, that's really all campaign commercials do. And what Benoit and other political scientists have found is that there's been remarkably little innovation over the last 50 years. So while consumer ads tend to sort of prize originality, political ads actually seem to prize conformity, and that's one reason why they're so lame, as you mentioned in the introduction.
Interesting aspect of it as well is that you talk about how political advertisers have really come to some consensus on a visual shorthand for a lot of issues. I mean, jobs, for example, the one thing you always see is the candidate wearing that hard hat.
Sure. It's become almost sort of rote at this point. I mean, people have been subjected to so many political ads that campaign ad makers now tend to communicate with the public through a kind of visual shorthand, where if you want to say that your candidate's good on jobs, you put him in a hard hat and you have him point at a steel beam. And if you want to say he's good with seniors or on senior issues, you put him around a lot of old people sort of looking up at him happily and you know, looking as though they've just been bestowed with prescription drug benefits. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do education, you get sort of multiracial kindergartners because, you know, teenagers risk looking surly. And everybody knows what I'm talking about, I'm sure.
And as you go through these things, you can sort of envision every political ad you've ever seen.
You really can. I mean, one of the remarkable things is that, you know, because there's been so little innovation, because you have the same media consultants making ads for the same races year in, year out, you know, all across the country, it basically tends to be the same sort of canned ads over and over and over, regardless of campaign or race. And finally, you know, one company dispensed with any illusion of originality in the 2002 election cycle and started selling pre-taped ads to candidates where they could just sort of plug in their name and their campaign and basically buy political ads the way you'd buy suits off a rack.
In fact, that company's name is Politically E, and today we took the liberty of downloading a couple of these generic spots from their website. You heard one at the beginning of the program, and let's listen to this one. This is an ad for Mike the Candidate.
Remember when it was just expected that students learn to read, write, and do basic math? Today, schools are modern and better equipped than ever before. But in spite of all these advantages, test scores are down, dropouts are up, and violence is all too common. On Election Day, vote for Mike the Candidate. He'll make a difference you can see. Paid for by the Committee to Elect Mike the Candidate for Public Office.
I'm Mike the Candidate, and I approve this message.
And Mike's that numbers, sounds like just about every political commercial I've ever heard in my life.
Mike's numbers are going way up after this show, I'll tell you. Let's at this point bring in our next guest, who is a person who actually makes political advertising. John Brabender is Chief Creative Officer of Brabender Cox. He runs political and commercial media campaigns. He's with us now from his office in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for being here. I'm almost embarrassed to be here now after that introduction of our industry.
Well, you wouldn't vote for Mike the Candidate after that?
Well, I'll tell you, what I'm trying to figure out is if you can buy that over the Internet, are they going to go retail after this? Where literally you can go and pick out the suits that you need to wear, the ads you need to wear, and maybe a canned speech here or there at one retail outlet that's going to be existing.
I wasn't the one who looked at their website, but the production assistant, Brendan Banaszak, who did, says they'll do all that for you. You're out of business there, John.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, and I say this a lot, that political advertising has become a lot like fast food. You know, it's cooked up in a hurry, it smells and tastes the same all the time, and often it gives you indigestion. And all they're doing is adding the drive-through, process in this. it really generally is very poor. And there's some good reasons why it's poor, believe it or not. The good reasons are, unlike commercial advertisers who might spend $1 million on an ad and let that ad run for 6 months, a political ad cycle could be as little as a week or even less than that. So no one's going to spend $1 million, nor do candidates usually have that type of money. But putting that aside, political ads still are pretty bad, and they could be a lot better if people went and did the process the right way.
Is one reason they're so bad that the stakes are so high? I mean, even if you do a new Coke, 6 months later you can change your mind. In a political race, you got only one election day.
I think there's a lot to that. I think that candidates get nervous. And frankly, you'll hear in the advertising industry a lot, the best ads are the ones when you first see them make you actually feel uncomfortable. And it's because they're not the same thing that you've seen over and over again. In the political world, there's this fear of always doing the wrong thing, saying the wrong thing, so there's a tendency to be so vanilla that you're just totally missed.
And Josh Green, as John talks about all of those qualities, this applies to almost every candidate of any party. I mean, he tends to make ads for Republicans, but this is true of Democrats and
this is
anybody.
Definitely true of Democrats and Republicans at almost every level, from sort of first selectman up to president. But there are a few good news stories, and we should probably mention that I singled John Brabender out in my piece as one of the few who's going against the grain. And who's kind of brings some of the creativity and humor of the beer commercials that you and I like so much, Neil, to political ads. And because of that, I think John's ads stand out from the rest. They're fun to watch. As a viewer, you pay attention. And ultimately, that's what any candidate should want out of a political ad.
John, tell us about the one you made that didn't get to run because Howard Dean did not get to be the Democratic presidential nominee.
Well, I, as well as a lot of Democrats, were disappointed when that happened. I was, because I didn't get to run the ad I wanted to run again. But basically, there was a story that came out that Howard Dean had basically got a deferment from the military after showing up at a recruitment office with an X-ray showing he had a bad back. And that very same year was documented that he went on skiing. In fact, some people described him as an expert skier, where he did moguls and everything else. Well, we had an ad ready to go where it showed basically starts out with just a lot of clouds and Howard Dean's name in there. And it talks about Howard Dean going to a recruitment office and so forth. All of a sudden, you see a skier come flying out of the clouds and going over you, and the ad goes on to finish by saying, actually, knowing this, Howard Dean would be the perfect commander-in-chief in case we ever went to war against Switzerland. And meant to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek humor, but creatively, hopefully, making the point that would be important to a lot of people in determining their vote.
Now, could you imagine the Bush campaign actually saying, yep, go ahead, let's do it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Part of the problem with the creative is not just the consultants who seem, you know, ready to put almost anything on, but it's also clients and candidates who are afraid to put things on it. And I will tell you, the best work I've ever done has been for candidates and some of them very well known who have said, hey, I want my stuff to stand out. I understand word intrusion in people's life. Take some chances and do that. And I've had candidates, you know, who would feel very comfortable putting this on. And almost every time that happens, they're rewarded in the poll numbers.
Yeah, Neil, and I think a perfect example of this is Jesse Ventura. If you remember, he came out of nowhere with these wonderfully creative ads made by Bill Hilsman that were sort of funny and ironic, and lo and behold, he became governor of Minnesota. So there's a case to be made that these can be very effective and stand out from the normal lousy ads that are usually in the background during campaign season.
We're talking about political advertisements and why they are less than brilliant often. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Margaret, who's with us from Overland Park, Kansas.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that our congressman here in Kansas, the 3rd District of Kansas, had a wonderful campaign ad in the 2002 election, and he did win, which is that he played his guitar.
Did he play it well?
He did. He played it very well. He would probably admit that he's not a professional guitar player. He's actually a professional politician. But he did a very good job. He played This Land Is Your Land, and he sang. And I found it really refreshing because it didn't go negative. He didn't actually go negative anyway until the very, very end, and his opponent did it first. But this was just a great ad, and I'd like to see more of that.
Okay, and did you vote for him, Margaret?
Of course I did.
On the basis of that ad or as on the basis of his political party?
Let's just say that solidified it. He's a Democrat, and he did a great job.
Okay, Margaret. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Margaret, John Brabender tends to reinforce your suspicion that if you go out on a bit of a limb even, you'd do all right.
Well, not only that, the point she was also making is that when a candidate lets themselves be shown as something that's real and not something that's too slick, that has a teleprompter in front of them and so forth, that they actually like that, that they feel that they can trust that person. Plus, that type of thing jumps out. I mean, you know, people give a commercial about 4 seconds, whether they decide they're going to invest the rest of the amount of time to watch it or not. And if you don't grab them right away, if it just looks like every other political ad, they're just going to ignore it.
And indeed, Josh, you write about because political ads look so much the same, campaigns have to spend an enormous amount of money so that we'll even notice them.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. About 30 years ago, General Electric conducted a famous study of television ads, which showed that it took about 3 viewings for a commercial ad to register with viewers. You know, because of the proliferation in cable channels and media outlets today, it takes about 5 or 6 for a consumer ad. But for some political ads, it can take as many as 20 viewings to register with people. One presumes because they're sort of lousy, unmemorable ads. But rather than sort of choosing to make more creative ads, which would take fewer airings to register and presumably cost a little bit less, most political ad makers have chosen instead to kind of pound viewers into this distracted submission with the same mediocre product. And I think a lot of people, especially in battlegrounds states right now, can understand what that feels like.
And John Brabender, does that suggest that underfunded underdogs might be more willing to take a chance on an ad with greater impact per showing?
There's no doubt about that. They understand that they have to take some chances. And generally, I can tell you from my agency standpoint, some of the best work we've had have been for challengers instead of incumbents. And ultimately, a lot of those challengers have had big upsets because of those ads.
Though the way a lot of districts are drawn on congressional races, upsets on that level are fewer and fewer, harder and harder to come by. John Brabender, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Brabender joined us from his office in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he's Chief Strategic and Creative Officer for Brabender Cox. We're going to continue our conversation with Josh Green of the Atlantic Monthly, the author of Dumb and Dumber, Why Are Campaign Commercials So Bad? We're also going to be joined by Kathleen Hall Jamieson after we come back from a break, who does analysis of campaign advertising. And, of course, more of your calls. You can also email us, totn@npr.org. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how politicians market themselves on radio and television, how it's changed over time. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with Kathleen Hall Jamison of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania about this year's political ads. But right now, we're talking with Josh Green, the senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly, about his article, Dumb and Dumber, Why Are Campaign Commercials So Bad? And let's get another caller on the line. Fred is with us from Buffalo, New York.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm always proud to be on Talk of the Nation whenever I get through.
Well, good. We're glad you keep calling.
I only get to listen occasionally because of my job. But anyways, my favorite ads were Ralph Nader's presidential campaign ads 4 years ago.
I honestly don't remember them. You're going to have to remind me.
Oh, the parody of the Monster ad.
Uh-huh.
Monster job hunting site.
Using sure.
The exact same kid actors in the exact same settings, saying similar things. At first, in fact, I thought it was the Monster ad, but then I noticed they were talking about when I grow up, I want to be taken for granted and stuff like that. Oh, I'm surprised you didn't remember that one.
Well, I'm not sure they ran too often, but...
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's true.
Maybe I didn't see them three times, and clearly...
Yes. And also the parody of the MasterCard ad, you know, about planes and how much they cost and buses and ads on what they cost and the candidates who can't be bought priceless.
Mm-hmm.
The MasterCard people got all mad at them and give them a cease and desist order, so that kind of disappeared quickly, too.
Well, there used to be a rule that there's no such thing as bad publicity, but I guess they decided they might be.
Yeah, and I think the fact that those ads register and that you remember them so well 4 years later sort of speaks to John Brabender's idea that if you're creative enough and if you sort of set yourself apart from the political norm enough, you really can sort of register with people.
And again, that underdogs taking a chance are more likely to take
that outsiders are much more willing to sort of risk doing something unconventional.
Yeah, so. It's a shame I didn't record them. Now they're gone.
I'm sure they're somewhere.
Nader will be back with a new vice president, and I'm sure many more creative political ads this cycle.
Yeah, but I wanted to add a suggestion. I hope Mr. Kerry can hear this, if he's tuned in today. I might suggest that John Kerry would play his guitar, as the lady was just mentioning about the congressman.
He was in a band when he was in prep school.
Yes, and he's a serious classical guitarist now, that he would, if he would do that for TV, and also, in fact, I think he should do that on the road, start every campaign, every rally with a performance of something by Bach or Vivaldi or something.
I don't know. I see him more as a guitar smasher. Maybe he could light it on
fire.
Yeah,
I'm not sure the Vivaldi's going to help him with the NASCAR dads, but...
maybe you could get a pedal string and get a whole new crowd behind
him. Or some Skinnerd.
Well, maybe. But anyways, I think you should, or even perhaps get some guitar company to endorse him, you know, mm-hmm. or vice versa. Say, I play Gibson, or I play Fender.
There you go. That might help him. Fred, thanks very much for the call and the suggestion.
Sure thing.
Bye-bye. And Joshua Green, before we let you go, I did want to ask about one aspect of the study that you did, or the piece you did in the Atlantic Monthly, and that is about the decision to go negative. In fact, that this is a very calculated decision by a lot of campaign staffs who, despite the fact that Americans say overwhelmingly they don't like it when candidates go effective, they decide it works.
Yeah, one of the most remarkable figures we've seen from this presidential election cycle is that something like 75% to 80% of Bush's ads already have been negative, and we're still 5 months out from the election. And I think one of the reasons that this shouldn't be surprising is that negative ads really do work. And even if they don't like them, viewers are more apt to remember negative information than positive information. And because there are so many of them, research tends to show that even people who don't pay attention to ads or claim they're not influenced by them in fact are influenced by them, sometimes without even realizing it. So I think that explains a lot of the sort of negativity.
And another distinction is that political advertisers, well, they want 51%. They don't care about annoying 45%.
Yeah, unlike Bud Light, which wants to maximize its audience, which wants to sort of bring in as many customers as it possibly can. Politicians would never say this openly, but they really don't mind if they alienate people and drive down the vote, so long as they win 51% of the people who do show up on Election Day.
Josh Green is senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. He's the author of Dumb and Dumber, Why Are Campaign Commercials So Bad? It's in the July-August edition. Thanks very much for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
Joining us now is Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of several books on politics and advertising, including her latest, The 2000 Presidential Election and the Foundation of Party Politics. She joins us from Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia, and welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Just as a bit of background, what do Americans use political advertisements for?
Americans use political advertising to distinguish the candidates. In part, that's why a tag is an important part of advertising. When we say negative advertising, we're conflating two different meanings. When a tag legitimately differentiates on policy positions or biography, it helps the electorate determine whether those differences matter, and if so, whether they should shape a vote. When a tag is illegitimate, it lies. Or when a tag is personal, the electorate reacts negatively. The electorate doesn't dislike attack. It dislikes dirty attack or personal attack. What it learns from advertising is what issues the candidate thinks are most important, hence what the candidate's most likely to act on if the candidate becomes or is reelected president, and what the candidate thinks his strengths are and the opponent's weaknesses are.
And is that on the conscious level, or is a lot of this, Josh Green was saying earlier, is a lot of this unconscious?
When you talk about the issues that are going to be important to the electorate, the discussion that people have with family and friends raises it to a higher conscious level than it might otherwise be. And right now we don't have high levels of political attentiveness, and as a result that kind of conversation isn't occurring very much. But we don't know the extent to which ads are shaping people at a pre-conscious level or a level they can't articulate. What we do know is that the public gains information from advertising. Sometimes it's deceptive, often it's not. But that the electorate also gains a sense of the issue priorities of the two candidates. And when people say that there's no substance to advertising, advertising basically only does three things, they're confusing the general intent of the ad, that is, it wants to defend or it wants to attack or it wants to bolster in some way, mm-hmm. with the specifics that help you get to that outcome. For example, right now, let's take a quick look at information that you can gain on each side. Kerry's got an ad on the air that talks about 43 million who don't have health care. He means health care insurance, but let's give him that he means health care insurance. He's going to focus on that as an issue if he becomes president, more so than President Bush will if he's reelected. The ad's telling you that, and it's telling you that accurately. There are real differences under that. To get the differences, you've got to read the newspapers, you've got to listen to NPR, you've got to watch news. Let's look at what Bush is telling us. Although his ads are now rolling off the air, there still are a few left on cable. And one on cable is saying, largest tax relief in history. Well, that's what he promised us in 2000. He's saying, I delivered. And then he says, 1.4 million jobs added since August. True. Inflation, interest, and mortgage rates low. True. Record home ownership. True. What he's saying is, take into account what I promised you, lower taxes, and draw the inference that I produced these other good outcomes in the process, you ought to reelect me. Now, right there, you see a difference. Kerry would repeal the tax cuts for those making over $200,000 to do what? Pay for his health insurance. Is there substance there? Yes. Does it bolster the candidates? Yes, it does. Does it defend their positions? It certainly does. And at the end of that Bush ad, does it attack Kerry? Well, yes, it does that too.
Well, let's get some more listeners involved in the conversation. Nicole is with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Listen, I was thinking a couple months ago, before the Democratic field was thinned out, CNN and Rock the Vote had a great debate aimed at young people and issues that young people care about. And one of the assignments during the debate was for each one to come up with a 30-second spot that would appeal to young people. These were great ads. They were fantastic. Wesley Clark's was by far the best, though, and it got a fantastic reaction from the crowd that was there and from the young people I work with, for example. And I'm wondering when, I'm sure that they don't have commercials that appeal to young people because young people don't tend to vote. But if we could mobilize this population through something like commercials or advertising or the way that they're marketed to now, why hasn't some candidate figured this out and really mobilized the youth vote in this way? I'm wondering if anybody's done analysis on that.
Kathleen Hall Jamison?
Well, first, I agree with you. I love those ads. And the energy underlying the ads, the rapid pacing of the visuals, was among the things that made them the most intriguing. One of the things that we know is that the older audience is put off by the rapidly paced visuals that the younger audience likes. And so what part of the problem when you're trying to address both of those audiences is what appeals the most to one tends to turn the other off. Why don't the candidates address more ads to the young? Great question. It's because The young audience is less likely to vote, and so per dollar spent, there's less political yield. And here you've articulated the dilemma very well. If you don't talk to them, how do you expect to get them to be interested in politics? How do you expect them to think that they are valued by you and that you should engage on the issues that matter, become part of the voting electorate? One of the things that is happening, however, is with the rise of the Internet and the capacity to target tightly through the Internet, we're seeing an increase in ads that are moving to try to reach that younger viewer who's more likely to be online than to watch network news or to pay attention to the traditional venues in which advertising is delivered to the older population, which is still a more news-reliant population, or I should say more traditionally news-reliant. That is, it's paying more attention to traditional sources.
I think there was one campaign this year where a candidate in Missouri was caught out in ads targeted for rural markets. The candidate pronounced the state's name Missouri, and in the ads for St. Louis, it was Missouri. So I think you do get some breakdowns like that, Nicole, but not to the fine demographics that you're talking about. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk with Alan, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Hi. I'd like to propose something. Perhaps the reason advertisements are so bad, as you put it, is because they work. To draw a comparison, American Idol may not be what people consider good art, or reality TV may not be good viewing, but it really pulls in the voters. So perhaps this is more of a commentator on the American electorate, because that's what will pull in votes.
Kathleen Hall Jameson, does that cut any ice with you?
Yes, actually, we know that people are more likely to remember information that is attack-based than information that builds a positive case. And as a result, the cost that it takes in order to get that message through is lower than the cost that it takes to make your positive positive message resonate. That's probably because the things that are negative in our environment are things that have high costs if we don't pay attention to them. So, for example, it's the person back in the cave who saw the predator stalking outside who's probably most likely to survive to reproduce the next generation to watch for the same predator. There's something, as a result, very appealing about moving to that level very quickly in politics. But I don't want to suggest that in the process of saying that attack moves more quickly, moves more viscerally, people remember it more quickly and they remember it longer, that it is somehow illegitimate. The differentiation between two candidates that's based on attack is in fact helpful to viewers as long as it's accurate and they find it useful as long as it's not personal or deceptive.
Here's an email we got from Rose in San Diego. I've liked few political commercials, can't remember most of those that I've seen, even if they were acceptable to me, but I do remember one from a long time ago. In the first presidential race after my becoming an eligible voter, there was a pro-Reagan ad that showed a tired mother trying to stretch the peanut butter into just one more sandwich for the children at the table. I don't remember the specifics of the voiceover, but it came down to the Democrats, peanut butter was brilliant, as Carter was president, were taxing families out of existence, and the Republicans, Reagan, were the best candidates for the job. I found the visual has stayed with me all these years. It was not overtly an attack on the incumbent, but the peanut butter imagery did all of that for them.
I think that's an attack ad from 1984 against Mondale. And the argument was on the Republican side that by promising to increase taxes in order to pay down the deficit, what Mondale was essentially going to do is cut the resources of the middle class, hence cut the peanut butter. And I agree with your caller, that was a very effective ad.
We're talking with Kathleen Hall Jameson about political advertising. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get to this year's ads, Kathleen Hall Jameson. How do this year's presidential ad campaigns compare to other years? I know for one thing, they seem to be starting a lot earlier.
Yes, they're starting earlier. The presidential campaign season effectively began the moment the primaries were wrapped up by Kerry. The dollar amounts spent are unparalleled. And as a result, it's very difficult to answer any comparative questions about this period because this period doesn't compare to a comparable period in the past. To get this level of advertising in battleground states, you've got to go back to general elections in the past. And as a result, what you have is a different dynamic at play right now. You have a dynamic in which the attacks have come out early on the Bush side against Kerry, and it raises the question, will the campaign ultimately level out to be a more accurate campaign as the attacks are scrutinized for inaccuracy and a penalty put in place potentially for continuing them?
Now, your organization is among several that are fact-checking all of the ads. How are they doing?
Well, the organization is called factcheck.org. You can find it with capital F, capital C.org on the Annenberg Public Policy Center webpage or just by checking factcheck.org through Google or one of the other searches. We've been fact-checking every ad that we can find, and we appreciate help in locating those ads. And what we found is that you've got many ads that have small inaccuracies. For example, when the Bush ad that I referred to earlier says that this is the largest tax cut, you could argue that, adjusted for inflation and related to GDP, Reagan's was actually larger, but the underlying truth that it was large is, in fact, there. It was a very large tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
On Kerry's HAP, you need to make sure that when people hear him talking about $43 million without health care, they know that he means health care insurance. And he probably should have said that, but those are small inaccuracies. Then you've got some larger inaccuracies that have been repeatedly put back into context in news media. And the question is, has the public picked up the message? The Democrats have exaggerated the extent to which jobs were lost during the Bush administration.
3 million, they always say.
Yeah, or 2.3 to 3 million. And the Republicans have exaggerated the extent to which Kerry's past votes on defense differed from the positions taken by President Bush Sr. and his own team.
Now let's get another caller in on the conversation. John is with us from Detroit.
Hi.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Okay. My question or comment or whatever has to do with the type of commercials that are run for particularly presidents, governors, and senators where they don't use the humor and the irony that we see on the usual product commercials on the television because they want to appear presidential or senatorial or gubernatorial, and wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Some of the most effective political advertising uses humor. And so, for example, the Bush ad against Kerry that suggests that he in the past supported an increase in the gas tax, it implies falsely that he does at present, uses kind of rapidly paced old cuts that look like they came from newsreels from the turn of the century. And the bouncy music and the strange video undercuts the claim in a way that makes it less likely that you think that it is the strong attack that it actually is. We know from research that ads that use humor fall into the same category as attack ads. They are more memorable than ads that don't use humor. And they're also disarming. They undercut the sense that it is a strong attack, even when, in fact, that's what's happening.
John, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
We'll have more with Kathleen Hall Jamieson on political advertising after a short break. We're also going to be talking when we come back about a new list of reading bests. This is not the best seller list with which we're all familiar, but the most borrowed list from LibraryJournal.com. Interesting to compare the differences between those two lists. Our conversation, if you'd like to join it, is at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN, at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about political advertising this presidential election year. Our guest is Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of several books, most recently The 2000 Presidential Election and the Foundations of Party Politics. And here's an email we got from Joseph Finneran and here in Washington, D.C. There have been some very creative ads by both Kerry and Bush on the web. Kerry's been buying a lot of space on NYTimes.com with the disrespectful flash animations jabbing the president, and the Bush folks made a great ad using the recent cicadas. I'd be curious to hear your guest speak as to why the Internet seems to allow for better ads.
The Internet is closer right now in its preference for genres, in the kinds of genres that are being used, to political cartoons than to the realism of broadcast ads. And so the kinds of parody that you see ordinarily in cartoons and also cartoon-like figures are far more common on the web. I think part of the reason is that you've got very low cost on the web, and so you've got new creators coming onto the web in higher numbers. You also have less of a sense of what is appropriate and inappropriate. You know, television, because of our exposure from childhood to it, teaches us what we should and should not do and constrains artistic impulses. Where in the internet, you still have the wild, wild west, the wide open frontier. And I think the creative impulses are liberated a little bit there.
Well, let's get another caller in. Steve joins us from Cleveland.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Couple comments. First, I think the ads, particularly the negativity, are just also a general reflection of the current political climate. And I think people, I work in a job, I work for a union, so as a staff rep, so I'm in a position where I talk politics a lot to people practically daily. And, you know, I hear all the time from people that they're tired of having to choose between the lesser of two evils. And I think the advertisements reflect that and it seems like the candidates acknowledge that.
I know you've got another point, Steve, but let's ask Kathleen Hall Jamieson about, are we historically more negative now than we used to be?
There's more attack in this campaign, if you assume the presidential campaign started at the end of the primary season, than there has been historically in the early general election period. We're at about the attack level that we are in the last month of the typical general election campaign of the last three cycles. But more importantly, there have been some very strong ads that made the case for the candidates. Kerry won Iowa with a biographical ad that told people who he was using narration from the folks who were with him on the boat in Vietnam. And while Gebhardt and Dean were destroying each other with attacks, that Kerry ad cut through the clutter and propelled him into the nomination. The early Bush ad in this primary cycle, in the general election cycle, as we're coming out of the primaries, that produced the most controversy was also, I think, the most powerful positive ad put out by the Bush campaign. That was the one that evoked the images of September 11th, produced the controversy about the momentary image of the flag-draped coffin, but nonetheless was a powerful evocation of a moment in time in which presidential leadership was showcased. Those two ads had a power that is emotional and positive that the attack ads can't ever have. They're appealing to fear. They're trying to generate anger. At their worst, they're inviting cynicism and hostility toward the other candidates, while they also are making some legitimate claims that differentiate.
Steve?
Well, the other thing I wanted to mention was I think some of the most influential ads and creative ads have been from MoveOn.org this time around, particularly the one that showed earlier in the year with the children working the jobs, paying for their future. And,
That was the one that won. They had a contest for a best advertisement, best anti-Bush advertisement, and that's the one that won. I just wanted to ask, Steve, you wanted to make one more point?
Well, no, I just know that it got in people that I talked to that that was constantly brought up, and people still talk about that ad as one of the best ads they've seen.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, obviously these outside groups, these 527 groups, as they're known because of the strange way the law is written, they're a big factor this time around.
They're a big factor, and it is their attack on Bush that is leveling the amount of attack on each side, because they are primarily attacking, and as a result, the Kerry campaign doesn't have to pick up as much of that burden. They're performing the function that party advertising performed until McCain-Feingold took party advertising off the scene. In the last two general election campaigns, it was the party ads that carried most of the burden of attack, while the candidates' ads took on the burden of making their own case. And let me just add a quick comment about that Move On ad. When people say advertising doesn't feature things that are important, and by the way, some of the big things that are important you can't find a way to talk about in politics, that ad was a lovely way of saying the deficit matters. Here's how it matters. See the effect on our children.
We've got a couple of these ads from both sides, and a question for you after we hear them. But this group, Citizens United, put out an ad against John Kerry that it's another spoof, I guess, of the MasterCard commercials.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Hairstyle by Christoph's, $75. Designer shirts, $250. 42-foot luxury yacht, $1 million. Four lavish mansions and beachfront estate, over $30 million. Another rich liberal elitist from Massachusetts who claims he's a man of the people. Priceless.
And here's one of the ads produced by MoveOn.org, and this one criticizes President Bush.
When George Bush testifies, here's what he should say. Before 9/11, I was obsessed with Iraq. Then I used 9/11 as an excuse to invade Iraq. So now we're less safe than we were before. It's just like Richard Clark said.
By invading Iraq, the President of the United States has greatly undermined the war on terrorism. George Bush, a failure of leadership. Move On Pack is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
And Kathleen Hall Jamison, one of the things that political campaigns try to do very much is control their message. Do these outside groups advertising as at the same time they're trying to control their message, doesn't that make their job a lot more complicated?
Yes, it does. Part of the problem for the candidate occurs when those groups are so far off message that they actually create the mistaken impression that that's the message the candidate wants to be communicating. One of the things that's important to remember is that voters on the first 3 to 5 hearings of an ad don't even remember the source of the ad. They tend to draw the inference that if the ad attacks Bush, it must be a Kerry ad. If it attacks Kerry, it must be a Bush ad. So the first problem for a campaign occurs if people say, that was a sleazy ad, and as a result, blame someone who didn't sponsor it. The second thing that these ads do is carry a lot of the attack of the campaign so that the candidates don't. But the final thing that they do is push the boundaries of the discourse. It is true historically that the most problematic claims, the ones that are the most inaccurate, the ones that are the most problematic, that push the false inferences the hardest, have not been sponsored by the candidates. The candidates are afraid to create a backlash by carrying that content. They also don't want to get elected that way because it carries with it a taint. And as a result, it's historically true, going back to the early Political Action Committee ads, that the worst ads, that is, the most problematic, distortive ads in the history of the presidency, have been run by independent groups.
I guess we're going to see a lot more of that throughout the year.
I hope not.
And again, could you give us the web address for the fact-checking group that Annenberg is involved
in? Yes, that's run by Brooks Jackson. It's called factcheck.org. You can also find it by going to the Annenberg Public Policy Center page of the University of Pennsylvania. And you'll also see all of the results of our survey. By the end of the election, we will have interviewed 100,000 voters, and we do ask them about what they've learned from advertising.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She joined us from the Audio Post studios in Philadelphia.